mother wasn't all too happy about. Upon seeing me come home covered in welts and bruises after my first 2 days of training, she let me know exactly how she felt. "We have bills to pay, and you're wasting money letting guys beat you up? Have you thought that maybe you're too fragile for this?" I moved out soon after. In choosing to start over, I had to reevaluate my relationship with my mother. For so long, I had put her needs before my own. I had been the kind of kid to get slapped and thank her for the lesson. I had worried about her mental state while completely ignoring my own. I knew so much of her behavior was due to her disorder, but I couldn't be sure how much. Had her bipolar caused her to hurt and doubt me? Had it been in control when she put her pain before my father's and ended up in the hospital the week of Grandpa's death? Was she secretly happy I was back under her control, even if it meant going nowhere in life? I couldn't help but resent the situation. I didn't know what was appropriate to feel. Can you be mad at someone for being sick? All I knew was that I needed space. I didn't want to resent my mother. It was bipolar disorder that became my greatest enemy, not her, I hoped. I would do my best to provide her with the help she needed, but what I needed was distance. I gave myself what I needed, despite her wishes. Erica needed a roommate, and I was making enough money to, at least try, to pay half of the rent. Having to still help my parents with their bills and paying for training meant that we were stretched a little thin. Sure, we didn't have cable. I slept on a couch in the living room. And we ate plain rice for every meal, but hell, we were surviving on our own. After a lot of trial and error, Ma had found a particular regimen of medicine that controlled her disorder and wild mood swings. And for the first time, I felt like it was okay to put my needs first. But after a week of training, I began to worry that she had been right about my chances for success. Life. Every wrestler inevitably gets asked the question, is wrestling real? By some rude stranger who is convinced they're being original, in a quiet, gravely serious tone of voice one might use when asking a CIA operative about the magic bullet theory. They ready themselves for the inside scoop they have neither earned nor are prepared to handle. I always giggle at this. For one, this question comes off just as intrusive and indelicate as walking up to a woman and asking if she waxes her mustache. They know there is a level of magic and work that gives them a pleasing end result, but for some reason they can't help but want to have their bubble popped. And they never actually desire the painful truth. Wrestling requires a suspension of disbelief, like any other scripted television show. It is planned and choreographed. It is a dance between two people skilled enough to appear like they are killing each other while taking every precaution to keep the other safe. The outcome of every match is predetermined. The wrestlers who win or are prominent figures are the wrestlers the company has faith in to make it the most money through ticket sales, ratings, and merchandise. It is an entertainment business like any other, but with the caveat of sometimes breaking bones. Just because something is planned doesn't mean the physicality hurts any less. If someone tells me they're going to punch me in the mouth, does that make the punch hurt any less just because I know it's coming? I'd argue it takes bigger balls to know that pain is coming your way and not run in the other direction. When done right, pro wrestling can and should be a work of art. It combines the toughness and resiliency of stunt work with the improvisational skills of Saturday Night Live. There are no second takes. When performing in front of a live crowd, surrounded on all sides, there is no room for error, and sleight of hand must be perfectly imperceptible. Punches connect. Falls hurt. No, the ring is not a bouncy, padded trampoline. It is made of metal, wood, and an inch of foam padding. And sometimes you need to improvise. A good wrestler doesn't need every move rehearsed, but reacts to the emotions and needs of the crowd and adjusts accordingly, slyly letting the opponent know the changes without anyone in the crowd hearing the conversation. These skills are both perfected over time and innate in true performers. And that is exactly what wrestlers are, tough-ass performers. There has been and will probably always be an aura of traveling circus around the business, as many people find it to be the sideshow act of the entertainment industry. But it was an industry I took great pride in entering. I felt like a freak and an outcast, so naturally I would want to run away with the circus. And to this day, when anyone asks if wrestling is real, I let them know that dislocating both my kneecaps, dislocating my elbow, breaking my foot, getting over 7 concussions, displacing my hips, sciatica, shooting my tooth through my face, and the arthritis in my cervical spine certainly felt real. But 10 years ago, my bony little body had never experienced such pain and wasn't used to physical exertion. I hadn't so much as done one sit-up in my entire life. Clearly, I was not a natural athlete. I was clumsy and awkward, often just falling over during a strong gust of wind. Learning how to take my first bumps was a rude awakening. In wrestling, a bump is a way to fall flatly on your back while keeping your spine, hips, and head safe. With proper technique, wrestlers learn how to distribute the impact of a bump evenly across the top of their back, so the fall looks devastating, but they don't actually break their neck. During a match, a wrestler takes dozens of bumps. It is a basic, fundamental move you need to learn before moving on to anything else. The first bump I took felt like how I assume a gunshot to the spinal cord must feel like. It knocked all the wind out of me in one sharp, blinding blow. It was so painful, my body could not entirely process it, and so it became white noise reverberating through my bones until it circled all the way back to painful. After assuring myself I had not crapped my pants, I did 200 more in a row. I only remember this number because one of my trainers counted out loud while laughing. That was day one. Day two was the exact same thing, except upon arriving home after my second training day, I spent 45 minutes hugging the toilet and projectile vomiting. My body was not handling physical activity so well. Eventually, the vomiting turned into dehydration, which was then followed by uncontrollable chills, which naturally led to full-blown pneumonia. As I spent the next few days laid up in bed, I wondered what the hell I had done to myself. I basically paid someone to beat me up and make me sick for a week. Could I really handle this? Was I actually strong enough to be a wrestler? But I went back the week after, and the week after that, I got my first concussion and my first broken bone within 6 months of training. The concussion with a 300-pound man accidentally slammed my head directly into the mat, and the broken foot when another guy threw me over his head into a backflip. I was the only girl training at the school, but you wouldn't know it by how the guys treated me. My classmates were accepting and encouraging and just saw me as one of the boys. They were specifically instructed not to take it easy on me. Not only did they avoid babying me, but they took it upon themselves to see exactly how much damage I could absorb without exploding into dust. We would run through training drills and practice matches together. Sure, everyone was 3 times as big as I was, but I still had to try to lift their entire bodies to suplex each and every one of them, just the same. It was an amazing experience. Actually being inside of a ring, though smaller and cheaper than a professional TV setup, was mind-blowing. The first time I tried to enter the sacred squared circle, I was told some people like to wipe their shoes on the edge of the mat before stepping through the ropes. It was a sign of respect to the ring. While staring at the puddles of sweat on the canvas, the 95-degree building refused to allow to dry up, and the smatters of blood covering almost every other inch. I laughed at the idea that my shoes would somehow make the mat dirtier. But the small gesture to show the 16-by-16 area I had long dreamed of entering, that I would respect and cherish it, struck a chord in me. It was a long road to get to the simple moment of stepping between the ropes. And so for the next 10 years, I would wipe my shoes each time I entered a wrestling ring. Inside of those ropes, I felt invincible. I could get knocked down a million times, but get up a million and one. I could fly off the top rope, suspended in air like a tried and true superhero in spandex. I was actually, finally, encouraged to take my aggression out through physical violence. Here, inside of these crudely taped together cable wires posing as ring ropes, I could fight back. Here, violence was an art form. Over time, my injuries became battle scars. I was proud of them. The bruises, cuts, concussions, and casts were all tangible proof I could truly be strong. I'm not sure if the exercise affected my serotonin levels or if the physical activity provided me with steady endorphins, but for the first time in years, I actually felt in control of my shaky brain. Even though I lay on a hand-me-down couch in a living room, I finally began to sleep soundly every night. Death. Everything was falling into place, which I should have realized is also how the first people to die in horror movies feel. I had a bank account and an apartment and was studying my craft. My mother seemed to have finally hit her stride in treatment and medication. There was a time at her sickest when I would answer her phone calls and realize she was already in the middle of an expletive-filled, nonsensical sentence. But now, we were actually able to communicate. Phone calls were civil and sometimes even shockingly pleasant. Erica and I had avoided visiting our parents' apartment for a little over a month. When we moved out, we thought weaning them off their reliance on us would be exactly the tough love they needed. They had spent years using us as crutches, but ultimately they were adults, and we believed adults would be able to stand on their own feet. The first month on our own, we were too strapped for cash to be able to help them with bills, and we felt like shit about it. We thought we would be able to live on our own and take care of them, but it was harder than we naively expected. And so, we tried to stuff our guilt down by simply avoiding being in the same room. It was the coward's way out, and I tried to find a way to ease my guilty mind. After cashing a check that was larger than usual, due to putting in some overtime hours, I decided to call Ma and ask if she needed anything for her fridge. They lived only a bus stop away from our new place, so I didn't have to lug the bag of groceries far. When I approached their building, a woman standing in his threshold greeted me. It took me almost 5 whole seconds to recognize my own mother. My heart stopped. The woman before me was rail thin. Her cheeks were sunken in, emphasizing the sharpness of the bones above them. Her eyes seemed as if they had been sucked into the depth of the sockets. The warm smile she greeted me with was almost too big for her now withered face. On her brittle frame was a size 2 tank top I had left behind. It engulfed the diminutive woman, who only a short time before was a healthy size 8. In just over a month, my mother had wasted away. We embraced, and the feel of her hard bones drained the life from me. The apartment I once called home for now felt foreign, smaller somehow, dirtier. Every surface was covered in dust. The glued-on plastic tile flooring stuck to my sneakers with each step. The scent of dog pee that permeated every room led me to believe Muggsy and Kagome had been relieving themselves indoors. The yellow-stained mop propped against the kitchen wall was a clear indicator that their messes were being hastily cleaned up, causing the sticky floors. When I opened the refrigerator to put away the groceries I had brought with me, it was empty. In just over a month, everything had gone to hell. How could they implode so fast? My mind raced to try and understand what had happened. There were plenty of years when we were younger when the fridge was bare and cash was tight, But for the past few years, it had felt like things were improving. Before Ma's breakdown, she was working full-time, and Dad had inherited a few thousand dollars after Grandpa's passing. I believed they would be capable of supporting themselves, but they somehow had no money for food, and Ma had become a shell of herself because of it. Dad was also alarmingly thinner than he had been the last time I saw him. Not only were they not eating, they seemed to lack the desire to clean and look after themselves. I worried they were both in the grips of a depressive state after having to live on their own essentially for the first time in their adulthood. I felt like I had entered a bizarro world and saw a glimpse of what my parents' lives would look like without us. But I was only a bus stop away, and it had only been a few weeks. The realization that the tough love and push toward independence had swiftly broken them crashed down on me like a 1,000-pound weight. What had I done? I felt like an ungrateful brat who had abandoned her parents after years of shared struggles. I was worried only about paying my bills and feeding myself, and had let them wither away in the process. I handed the rest of my paycheck to Ma and searched my mind for a way to undo my mistake. Robbie had been staying in Puerto Rico since our grandfather first became ill. Struggling with his PTSD, he had an episode there in which he believed his life was in danger and reactively flew to the States overnight. As he recovered in the apartment with Robert and Janet, he saw the condition they were living in, and we all decided it would be best for them to start over in Puerto Rico. Admittedly, I was relieved. It would be easier to only have to pay my parents' phone and grocery bills now that they lived rent-free in Robert's family home. But I still felt like I failed them. Again, I was given a responsibility, and I ended up a massive failure. It sent me into a tailspin. My neurosis took over. Sleep eluded me once more. The dark cloud reclaimed its spot hovering over my head. I wondered if I should re-enter therapy. It had been a while since I had gone, and maybe all I needed was to talk to someone about the heavy shame I was feeling. And then I remembered the prescription I had been given almost a year earlier. I searched for the plastic container and found it hidden within a dresser drawer. It was almost as if I was too afraid to get rid of it, but unable to look it in the proverbial eye. For months, I argued with myself about the need for antidepressants. A part of me was unwilling to let go of my training. The constant message preached to me that mental health was something a strong person could control on their own. My pride had stopped me from accepting the help of medicine. But this sadness felt deeper, more intrinsic than before, like its seeds were planted in the valves of my heart and its branches extended through my veins. I convinced myself my only options were to try the medication or to be crushed beneath the wicked weight hanging over me. I took one. The next day, I took another. And after a few weeks, I began to feel stranger than usual. Convincing myself this uneasy feeling was just the meds kicking in, I continued to take a pill every day for months, refilling the prescription a few times over. I expected my body to have some sort of side effects to the introduction of a foreign substance to my system. My doctor had warned me that there was a transitional period to every medicine. But still, I was blindsided when one day I woke up completely and utterly shattered. Upon opening my eyes, I realized my face was covered in tears, having apparently cried in my sleep throughout the night. I tried to eat breakfast, but it had no taste. And so I returned to my room, closed the shades, and crawled back into bed. After Erica had left her work, I called in sick to my own job. Sobs uncontrollably escaped my body. Why am I crying? I wondered, without worrying. I could feel something was wrong, but for some reason, that did not scare me. I felt strangely objective and removed from myself. as if I were watching this blubbering mess hiding from the world under a TJ Maxx discounted quilt. I grabbed the orange bottle from my dresser drawer and took a pill earlier than usual. An hour later, I woke up in tears again, but this time with a throbbing headache. Forcing myself out of the bed, I stumbled into the kitchen to find some Advil. Instead, I found a bottle of prescription painkillers I had received after breaking my foot, but remembered I had been too scared to take even one before. The side effects of such a potent pill intimidated me. If my body was in pain, I would find a way to tough through it. I could control that. Physical pain had never bothered me. I had taught myself to endure it, to numb myself from it. But this felt different. This consuming migraine didn't feel like a pain coming from my body. It came from deep within my soul. Maybe I would need to try a painkiller for the first time to combat it. And that's the last thing I remembered for a while. The next time I opened my eyes, Erica was speeding through red lights while I violently puked out the window of her car. I watched as a haze of chunks and bile splashed against the car door until my eyes began to roll to the back of my skull. My vision blurred. My heart raced so fast and hard I could feel it pulse in my arms, behind my eyes, in my throat. What the fuck was happening? What did I do to myself? The next few days were a blur of vomit, lab tests, and panic. When I finally felt my brain settle, with recognition of my surroundings, I shot up in the bed. I was not home. I was in a cold room on a hard hospital bed. One of my arms was attached to a bulky IV. The other was painfully extended with plastic tubes shooting out the center of it. Thick, black track marks replaced every single blue vein on the inside of my arms. Like a movie montage, the events surrounding my stupidity began to flash in front of my eyes. I had fucked up monumentally. In a deep, depressive state, I had overdosed on antidepressants and painkillers. I had almost died, trying to make an inner pain fade away. So was this a suicide attempt? Was it a cry for attention? The doctors labeled it an accidental overdose and didn't force me into a psychiatric ward like they had done to my mother. But was it an accident? Here's the truth. I've searched within myself for years for the answer, and have come up with only this. In the weakest moment of my life, without emotion and without thinking, I tried to make the pain stop. It felt like a mechanical and rational decision. There is pain. I cannot handle it. This might help. This might help more. I never told myself I wanted to die, but I never told myself I didn't. I just didn't care. Searching for a solution in that instant, I made an idiotic series of mistakes. I believe I should have been analyzed in a psych unit. It should have been treated like a suicide attempt, because something was deeply wrong with my brain and I could not handle it alone. When Erica came to pick me up, she was warm and a bit nervous. It was as if she didn't know how to treat me. She didn't want to come off as judgmental, but she was also hurt. This poor girl had picked our mother up from the hospital a year earlier, and this was eerily reminiscent. "I hope you know," she said, breaking the awkward silence. "You're going to have to clean my car." Rebirth. As we drove home from my shameful hospital visit, a realization hit me like lightning. It was all too similar. It was not a coincidence I was following my mother's footsteps. She was diagnosed with depression, and so was I. She overdosed, and so did I. But what doctors realized in her case was that she had been misdiagnosed to begin with. She was not depressed. She had been mistakenly diagnosed during a depressive cycle of her bipolar disorder. The antidepressants had the worst possible reaction they could have. I knew then and there that was what had happened to me. I knew in my heart I was bipolar. For a long time, I believed I was prone to depression when circumstances overwhelmed me. And so I thought if I stayed happy enough, I could fight back the darkness. Essentially, I was trying to put a band-aid on a festering wound. I thought if my erratic behavior had subsided for this long, it certainly meant it was gone for good. I excused my odd behavior as momentary depression. There were weeks I was incredibly, ridiculously happy. Getting to experience being inside of a wrestling ring had given me a strength and confidence I had never known. Having a full-time job, living as a proper adult, made me feel like I was on the path to success. So why couldn't I sleep at night? Nights I did manage to get some rest, I would wake up feeling off, heavy and dazed, as if I were shrouded in a dense fog. I began calling these my dark days. Days in which I would mope around, dragging my feet. My appetite would diminish, and even if I tried to eat, I would taste nothing. Within these days, often mid-sentence, I would break down into tears for absolutely no reason. But I wrote off all of it as moments of weakness. I didn't respect the possibility of inheriting my mother's mental illness. The hardest thing in the world is to accept that something is wrong with you, face the uphill road to recovery ahead, and realize that none of it makes you less than human. I had been so scared to end up as sick as my mother, I had refused to notice the warning signs. I wanted to think that I had little bouts of depression, caused by the heavy situations in my life, but that was not the truth. The truth was, I was bipolar, and I had been for several years. The only difference between me and my mother was that I was catching the culprit early on. I had a chance to end up differently, and I would never take that chance for granted. The day I got home from the hospital, I cut the plastic hospital band off my wrist and replaced it with three thin black bracelets. One, representing the life I had lived and the mistakes I had made. One representing the death I had escaped. And the last representing my second chance at life. My rebirth. I have worn them every day since. What comes next can be demoralizing for a lot of patients. I would eventually confirm my diagnosis with a professional. After that momentous occasion, finding the right medication and dosage can be a pain in the ass. Sometimes a treatment can take so long to produce any sort of result, you give up before you can get its full benefits. Oftentimes, medication meant to soothe the extreme emotions ends up dulling all of them. I spent a few months feeling like a robot in a cloud of smoke. But if you stick through the highs and lows of trying to control your highs and lows, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. My disorder is not something that can be cured, but its severity can certainly be controlled. The process takes guts. It takes a brave person to accept they need help and go get it. It takes an even braver person to not feel shame in the process. I understand psychiatry and therapy can be intimidating to a lot of people. After I found the right treatment and took the time to attend consistent therapy over the years, I felt so silly for waiting so long to finally find peace. If you are sick, you get medicine from a doctor. When people can see an injury or hear a cough, they take notice. That ailment is tangible. It is real. But when an illness cannot be seen, when it is felt, however deeply, people tend to ignore it. My family did not believe in mental illness. They thought it was a creation of pansies who couldn't tough it out when life got rough. And then it screwed us, without even having the courtesy to buy us dinner first. My mother had a breakdown. I suffered for years, and even Robbie was extra susceptible to PTSD, having a chemical imbalance already in his genetic makeup. We were forced to face how very real mental illness was only after it had had its way with us. What I wish for anyone listening to this audiobook who feels even the slightest worry that something could be wrong inside of them is that you find the strength to talk to someone about it. Get advice from someone who has experience. Talk to a friend who you know will support you. Or really sack up and go to therapy and bare your soul. You might just find exactly what you are looking for. As I've gotten older, I've become less tolerant of closed minds that think psychotherapy and psychology are tantamount to weakness. Being proactive takes a lot more strength than hiding. I know a lot of secure women and men who go to therapy. They don't see it as an admission of a flaw. They see it as a luxury, serving their minds the way a massage spoils the body. Some of the happiest couples I know go to couples therapy weekly, and that's why they are the happiest couples I know, because they take the time to check in with their emotions before a problem arises. And if modern medicine isn't your deal, then try homeopathic methods. Try meditation, anything. Just taking the time to put your mental health first, acknowledging that it deserves respect and care, and accepting help when you need it, can save your life. You are worth saving, and you are not alone. Diary of an Unfit Mind, Surviving Sisterhood. Growing up next to another set of blossoming ovaries will undoubtedly create some friction in your life. My sister and I have had a love story more tumultuous than Sam and Jason on General Hospital. She has been my surrogate mother, my best friend, and my worst enemy. We have made each other laugh almost as much as we have made each other bleed. We are complete opposites, and yet the perfect match. There's no relationship that has hurt me or healed me more. So here's my guide to surviving sisterhood. Boyfriends and girlfriends will come and go. Friends will try their best, but there is no bond more sacred than the one between two sisters who have been cursed with the same chubby nose. 1. Do your best to avoid fighting about how long it is still age appropriate to play with Barbies. A 2-year age difference is enough to ensure one sister will spend half an hour setting up an elaborate Barbie playdate, complete with makeshift Ricky Lake talk show set, only to have the other sister bounce within 5 minutes to walk around the mall with her stupid, stupid friends. Clothes. My sister and I shared a handful of clothes for over a decade. When we eventually got our own jobs and could buy our own stuff, the blood feud began. Your sister is going to want to borrow something you own. That plain black t-shirt will then suddenly transform into something so appealing you will protect it like Gollum in Lord of the Rings. Just share it. It's not worth losing wads of hair over. Unless it still has the tags on, you might as well be asking for a kidney. Boys. There was a boy in high school who, when dumped by my sister, tried to move in on me in a pretty twisted attempt at revenge. That is how stupid boys can be. In general, it's a good rule to just avoid fighting about guys altogether throughout life, with friends, other women, etc. Most guys are not worth fighting over. Trust me, the good ones will fight for you. The rest can kindly fuck off. Money. I always felt bad that my mother and her sisters were divided over money and promised myself that Erica and I would be different. And for the most part, we have done a stellar job of not letting money come between us. Unless you count that one time I didn't pay my half of the rent 6 months in a row, or that other time when she secretly drained my bank account to buy shoes. 2. Stay on her good side, because you never know when you'll need her to pay your half of the rent for the many years you're kind of a mess. To not secretly drain your bank account to buy shoes during the years she's kind of a mess. To loan you her bra in the middle of a school day because you forgot to wear one, because your boobs are non-existent, but you have to change in front of the other girls in gym class, and they actually have boobs, and those boobs are inside of bras. To let you know it is time to start plucking your eyebrows. to let you know you have grossly overplucked and can't pull off the Chola look, to read your shitty screenplays, to secretly buy you tampons, to describe in horrifyingly helpful detail how to use those tampons. 3. Remember, at the end of the day, only a sister would shave your legs for you when you are a crying, hairy 9-year-old who is too terrified to hold the blade for the first time. Buy Johnson & Johnson's No More Tangles Detangling Spray and comb the knots out of your hair when you are a lazy, disgustingly unkempt 14-year-old. Let you sneakily borrow her makeup when your mom thinks it'll just make you look like a cheap painted whore. Work overtime to make sure you get at least one Christmas present. Help plot bloody revenge on a boy who breaks your heart. Take turns writing only, "You are 1 year closer to death," in each other's birthday cards. Every year. Have a massive blowout of a fight and act like nothing happened the next day. Forgive you every time you are kind of a dick. Blindly believe you are capable of anything. Encourage you to chase even the wildest of dreams. Thank you for being my sister, Aerie. You're kind of okay. Shut up, don't make it weird. Chapter 9. I Want to Believe. Hitting rock bottom set me free. I felt like I had been given a clean slate, a second chance at life, and I sure as hell was going to make the most of it. When you're at your lowest, there really is nowhere else to go but up. My foundation was cracked. The whole building needed to be torn down and reconstructed. Every day felt like knocking down walls and gathering bricks. But brick by tedious brick, I would rebuild and become someone better. After taking the time to heal and learning about proper treatment, I was refocused and ready to continue the upward trajectory. Wrestling school was my primary focus. I trained for about a year before actually getting paid to wrestle. There are small promotions all over the country, and the world for that matter, that run wrestling shows in high school gyms, bingo halls, state fairs, basically any place you can build a ring and gather a crowd. Together, these promotions make up the independent circuit. Pretty much any wrestling that is not a part of the bigger promotions on television. The rings are more of the makeshift variety. The crowds can sometimes consist of less than 10 people. The pay is practically nothing, and the wrestlers can be dangerously undertrained. But getting any opportunity to live out the childhood fantasy of performing in front of a crowd made me unbelievably happy. Unfortunately, women on the circuit are not as plentiful as men. It was difficult to find companies that had any possible opponents for me to work with. The owner of my own training school didn't like the idea of having such a tiny, inexperienced woman wrestle on his events. "You're just so small, and these other girls are so much bigger than you. I'm scared you're going to be too fragile to handle it." There was that goddamn word again. I had proven my grit for a year now, and I was still being judged by my size. I knew he was concerned for my safety, but doubt coming from my own training grounds was demoralizing. I wasn't going to learn from people who were better than I was without getting the chance to enter a ring with them, so I looked to other promotions for work. A few companies gave me great opportunities to gain some experience and make a few bucks, and I mean a literal few. The most I ever made in one night was $40 after wrestling 4 different matches in a tournament. One time, a promoter let me know the show didn't sell enough tickets to actually pay any of the wrestlers at the end of the night, but he was kind enough to offer one free snack from his concession stand. Essentially, I was paid in French fries. Dream big, kids. It wasn't much of a profitable career, but I still felt like I was doing something worthwhile and important. I started to make a small name for myself on the independent circuit. Eventually, in early 2009, I became a tag team champion in a badass all-woman promotion. When one of the company's shows took place in a 20-degree movie theater with a ring that had tire-sized holes in it, only 2 working ropes, in front of a crowd of 4 men who just spent the evening touching themselves underneath their winter coats, I still went to bed with an accomplished smile on my face. Not because I was accidental spank material, but because I felt like I was doing it. I was actually becoming a wrestler, though the professional part was still a bit debatable. I had set a goal, and each day I was getting closer to achieving it. In 2008, one of the wrestlers from my training school mentioned the WWE was holding open tryouts. At first, this sounded like a glorious opportunity to get a contract with the biggest wrestling company in existence. The WWE had multiple shows on television and was known all over the world. I was excited until some of the other guys made it seem like a big scam. You have to pay $2,000 and get your own flight and hotel. I heard it was just a way to rip off suckers and pay for a new ring for their developmental team, one of the guys said, scoffing at the idea. But I wasn't quick to write it off. Sure, the WWE was certainly going to make a lot of money off any indie wrestler with $2,000 to spare, but it was still an opportunity. The tryout was a full-blown 3-day camp at the WWE's developmental facility in Tampa, Florida. This facility served as the company's minor leagues. New signees would move to Tampa and train at the school until they were promoted to a main roster spot on one of the company's network shows. WWE writers, producers, and agents would attend the tryout camp and watch the prospects train and put on matches. Whether or not it was just a cash play, there were going to be very real eyes with very real authority watching. Even if it was just a sliver, there was a chance. The problem was, I was working my butt off to barely make rent every month and didn't have that kind of extra cash lying around. If I did, I would have surely been using it to make it rain on my sister while she tried to sleep. There was absolutely no way I was going to be able to afford 2 flights, 4 nights in a hotel, and $2,000 to enter the camp. But rumor was, the tryout camp would be made into an annual occurrence. I was determined that the next time the opportunity came around, I would make sure I was ready for it. I decided I would need a new, better-paying job. Making $6 an hour, fetching coffee for pervy misogynists at the calling card company for the last year had helped me pay for wrestling school. But I needed to start doing better than living paycheck to paycheck. I also felt like the calling card company had run its course of survivability. Having under 25 employees, it was legal for the bosses to smoke indoors. And smoke in my chubby-cheeked, asthmatic face they did. When I had broken my foot, I was still not excused from carrying boxes up and down stairs into storage or fetching coffee whenever my boss snapped. And he literally snapped his fingers to get my attention. When I would bring the coffee behind his desk, more often than not, I would catch a quick glimpse of porn on his computer as he rushed to minimize its window. I envisioned throwing the scalding coffee all over him while I snapped 1,000 times in his now deformed face. I tried to deal with the grossness I could not shower off me at the end of the day, but the day he snapped his fingers and smugly called me baby, I told him I would be moving on. Though I wasn't qualified for much, I borrowed my sister's clothes, typed a malnourished resume using a really big font, and went on interview after interview. After a few weeks of searching, I was offered a job as a secretary. But this time I would have a sick view of the Hudson River from my desk, be treated with respect, and make enough money to afford cable. So it was a total upgrade. My new gig was at a beautiful day spa directly on the river in Hoboken, New Jersey. The manager liked my personality despite my lack of experience and hired me to man the front desk. If I wasn't thanking callers in a tranquil, hippie spa voice, I was staring out onto the water while listening to a nature sound CD on loop. I was making enough money to not feel guilty about buying a morning coffee to drink at my desk with a view, engulfed in the scent of lavender oil diffusers. Not taking into account the semi-regular callers inquiring about happy endings, this was the life. I would work 5 days a week, full-time at the spa. On weekends, I would travel around the tri-state area taking wrestling gigs. I finally bought my first cell phone and went on my first date. There are those who would argue that's late in life, but for me, they were both things I felt only came with maturity. I was in no rush to throw extra bills or responsibilities onto my plate, but I finally started to feel like I was getting my shit together. When the second WWE tryout camp was announced for May of 2009, I knew I couldn't miss out on it. Though I had saved up an impressive amount of money for someone who reused paper towels at least 3 times before throwing them away, I still hadn't met the amount I needed to pay for the whole trip. And so, I cut every corner I could think of. Each trip to the grocery store was twice as long, as I carefully sought out the cheapest chicken breasts, even if it was only by 5 cents. And forget name brand anything. The Mendez girls would enjoy meals of Compare to Kraft macaroni spirals. I began cutting meals altogether. Knowing what was at stake, I decided it was worth it to skip the beloved morning coffee I was just getting used to spoiling myself with. Eventually, I calculated how much I could save if I skipped lunch too. I had some moderately cheesy macaroni spirals or white rice waiting for me at home. I could survive a work day without food. Luckily, the spa always had a cracker and fruit plate out for guests to nibble on in the waiting room. So when a phone wasn't ringing and no one was around to catch me, I would tiptoe into the tranquilly decorated haven and stuff as many crackers and grapes as I could fit into a napkin without making too much of an obvious dent in the display. I would make several trips throughout the day, basically living off the lightest of finger food. One day, I almost blew my cover by eating too many crackers while only one guest had checked in. "Wow, Mrs. Anders must have been really hungry before her Brazilian. Half of the fruit plate is gone," one of the estheticians suspiciously noted. In 3 months of skimping on food to afford the tryout, I lost 15 pounds, weighing in at a scant 96 pounds. I looked sick and dangerously thin. Like if someone blinked fast enough, the wind their lashes created could thrust me across the room. But I had done it. I had saved enough money to apply to the tryout, pay the admission fee if I were accepted, and travel to the majestic, faraway land that neighbored Donald Duck. Erica and I were struggling to get by, now that a healthy portion of my checks was being squirreled away on a pipe dream. She was generous enough to let me come up short on rent so I could afford the tryout. But we were sorely lacking in simple essentials like food and bus fare. My spending over $2,000 on a mere chance was painful for her to sit back and watch, but she had enough faith in my determination to not stand in my way. A ray of glimmering hope came in the form of an email from a Hotmail account. Yes, that was once a thing. A small wrestling company offered me the opportunity to make some serious cash, and no, it was not to support a foreign prince in a pyramid scheme. A legitimate, up-and-coming wrestling company offered me $4,000 to take part in a 2-day shoot for its television pilot. That was more money than I had ever seen, and it was being extended to me like a lifeguard's hand the several times I almost drowned in a public pool. It could pay our rent for the next few months and stock our fridge and provide endless amusement when I inevitably covered my bed in it to make snow angels. I was beside myself with joy until I read the proposed date of the shoot. The pilot taping would overlap with the tryout camp I had prepared a year for. So here was my choice. Shoot a television pilot, be flown first class, and put up in a fancy hotel, on top of being handed more money than I had ever known could exist in one place. Or pay my last dime for a sliver of a chance I would see a return on that investment. It was as if a siren call was trying to lure me into the promise of riches. It took every ounce of Erica's strength to not slap me upside the head and order me to go earn the rent money I owed her. But we both knew I had to see this thing through. For a year, I had given my all to make this tryout possible. It was an investment, though a painful one, in myself. Though it hurt me to walk away from guaranteed money, I chose to take the chance. When I arrived in Tampa, I took one step off the plane and my hair grew 3 sizes like the Grinch's heart. Humidity was not my friend. The temperature and atmosphere though wreaking havoc on my already frizzy hair and oily skin, gave me a sense of nostalgia. Florida reminded me a lot of Puerto Rico, except there were more paved roads and slightly fewer machete-wielding grandmothers. Immediately, I was struck by the difference in attitudes of the locals. When I walked into a Walgreens, an employee greeted me with, "How's it going? Let me know if I can help you with anything." And I had to bite my tongue from yelling, "You want to start something?" in response. It took me a minute to realize people in the South actually greeted strangers, as opposed to prolonged eye contact starting a fist fight where I came from. I wasn't sure if she was really helpful or if I just looked really suspicious, but her alarming warmth actually turned out to be genuine. I would have to get used to this development if I succeeded in getting hired. If I got a contract, I would have to move here. I would leave cold winters behind for a solid year-round 80 degrees. I salivated at the idea. The palm trees and warm air reminded me of our time on the farm, the only time in my childhood I felt truly safe. Maybe that was a sign this tryout would go my way. The first day of the camp, over 70 applicants filled the small warehouse converted into a small wrestling arena. Three rows of metal chairs surrounded the ring used for the developmental roster's local shows. Behind the curtain at the top of the wrestler's entranceway were two more rings meant for daily practices. There was too much for my excited brain to absorb. First, I noticed how large the ring was compared to the indie ones I was used to. These were 20 by 20 and would require an extra 4 bounds for my tiny chihuahua gait while running the ropes. Next, my eyes fixed on the story-high fabric posters covering the entirety of the walls around the main ring. They were posters promoting pay-per-view specials and had the faces of every famous wrestler plastered on them. I made a mental note that I would have to make sure I made it onto one of these one day. Only three other women were among the candidates: a tall, blonde, foreign model, a dancer with a body so sexy, if I had it, I would never leave the house because I would be too busy staring at my naked body in a full-length mirror, and a fellow indie wrestler with 5 more years of experience than I had. Well, I'm boned, I thought. The candidates were split into 3 groups, one in each ring, and made to run basic drills together. After an hour, I felt a tap on my leg. Turning around, I met eyes with Tom Pritchard, a trainer at the school and a former wrestler in the tag teams, the Heavenly Bodies and the Bodydonnas. "They want you to cut a promo in the main room," he said as he motioned for me to follow him. Cutting a promo is wrestling terminology for performing a monologue. I quickly tried to figure out what was happening. The main room, housing the main show ring, was currently filled with all the candidates with over 5 years' experience, as well as agents, producers, and writers for the main roster program. I figured the less experienced wrestlers wouldn't have to worry about facing these intimidating decision makers for at least another 2 days. My event schedule had listed promo day at the end of the week. I was nowhere near ready during hour one of day one, but I didn't exactly have a choice now. When I entered the room, I immediately spotted the head of talent relations, Ty Bailey, along with a few main roster wrestlers. I walked into the center of the ring, alone, with a microphone in my hand, and completely froze up. "Why don't I have anything prepared? Everyone is staring at me, and I'm holding this microphone like I'm about to jerk it off. Say something. Anything." And then, as if guided by some sort of fairy godmother magic, words seamlessly escaped my mouth. There are 2 types of characters in wrestling: a babyface, aka the good guy, and a heel, aka the bad guy. For 2 years, I had practiced as and played the role of the babyface on the independent circuit. But for some reason known only to my frayed nerves, I cut a heel promo. I insulted everyone watching me and talked myself up like a conceited villain. It was nice to find out that my fight-or-flight instinct was to be a total dick. Whatever nonsense that came out of my mouth was ridiculous and off the cuff, but I delivered it with an unfaltering bravado. Fake it till you make it, I thought, shrugging. but apparently, the performance was good enough to get the attention of the people whose opinions mattered. For the next 2 days, I was filled with the confidence I had rarely felt within. Something about being noticed early on made me approach every camp challenge and task head-on. I had several matches, performed a few more promos, and was critiqued daily on how to improve. And then one of the wrestlers from the main roster watched a match of mine and gave me his 2 cents on what I needed to work on. "You're really skinny. I feel like someone could just break you in half." Then, directing his comments toward the crowded room of contestants listening, "You guys have to be prepared to look the part, not like some wannabe off the street." This comment devastated me. A wrestler talented enough to be in the main roster took one look at my body and let me know it wasn't up to snuff. I knew I had lost weight skimping on meals, but I was tired of being reminded how I was too small to be strong. My bubble of confidence was being tested. At the end of the week, all the hopefuls were gathered in the building's main room. We had heard rumors that someone might actually be announced as a contract winner that day, in front of the whole group in some sort of ceremony. Sitting in rows facing the main ring, it felt as if we were at the Oscars and everyone was nominated for the same award. Tensions were high, nails were bitten. I crossed my legs in my chair and stared at the floor. I heard rumblings that besides the one main contract winner, a few people might be offered contracts in the weeks to come. I had my hopes set on one of those. I knew that there was no way that out of 70 burly men and 3 more attractive and skilled women, my name would be called that day. I was at peace with that realization and excited to see which of the guys would get the chance of a lifetime. Ty Bailey stood in front of the shaking sea of muscles and self-tanner and thanked everyone for participating. He made some sort of moving speech, but all I heard was white noise until I saw everyone turn and look at me. As if his words traveled on a delay through sound waves, it took me what felt like an entire minute to actually hear the words. "Congratulations, April Mendez!" My fingernails clawed at my cheeks as I shot up from the chair. My legs were still crossed, so I almost face-planted, which would have been entirely consistent with my luck before that moment. Ty handed me a card that had something written on it. I shook his hand and then just collapsed onto the floor in a messy, crying heap. Imagine Halle Berry winning the Oscar, but with a heavier nose drip and looking substantially less endearing. I looked at the card in my hand and realized it was a business card on which Ty had scribbled "contract with WWE. It was hilariously unofficial, but only enhanced the absurdity of the moment. My competitors were genuinely warm and congratulatory, and I received 70 bear hugs in a row. It felt like the closing montage of every cheesy sports movie in existence. But it was actually the beginning of an even more absurd, trying, beautiful journey. The first person I called was Robbie. "Hey, remember that thing I promised when I was 12? Diary of an Unfit Mind. A letter to my future daughter. If you are reading this, congratulations! You can read! I am proud to have apparently done at least one thing right in your life. I once left my iPhone in the fridge for an entire night, and in the morning, checked for my alarm on a Dorito. So forgive me for appreciating I've gotten you this far. As I write this, I am 29 with abs of steel and an ass that I have on multiple occasions dared people to bounce a quarter off. If for some reason you have ruined any of this, I need you to know that I do not forgive you. I never really imagined myself as a mother. While my sister cherished her baby dolls, I created various ID channel-worthy reenactments in which they were kidnapped. Somewhere along the line, I must have become slightly more tender. The fact that you exist at all must be a testament to my newfound maturity, my embraced womanhood, my courage in accepting that life's greatest accomplishment is creating a lasting legacy in the form of a loving family. Or I forgot to take my pill that day. Either way, I might as well give you the guidance you need to become a strong, confident woman who never takes a duck face selfie. May your journey through life be easier than mine, but not so easy you